The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the ninth reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In Chapter 33 and partway through Chapter 37, the author, Mary Harper, began to tell her own story, the story of being a child of two blind parents in the 50s and 60s. She recounted how she, like her parents, became keenly attuned to her other senses, sound, touch, taste, and smell, and how really listening to the world around her became a source of joy. She relayed the freedom she felt on her bike, and then the freedom she shared with her father when a tandem bicycle became part of the family. She quickly moved into her adult years, college, marriage, starting a family, and we ended the book hour near the end of Chapter 37, just as Mary had inserted a letter her mother had written to her sister Rita, giving her views on her life at the time. Now, we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. July 21st. Happy birthday, Rita. Hope this will be one of the nicest birthdays you ever had. We think of all of you often and wish there weren't so many miles between us. It was good talking to you a while back, and we'll be calling you again soon. Hope Erica is rid of her problem and that you like your work. Things are going smoothly for us, even though Mary is gone. Our neighbors and friends are really helpful and quite friendly. I grocery shop with the man that drives us to church, and a friend of your dad's invites him out shopping occasionally. Others have offered us trips to the shopping center, so actually we are doing well enough. On the 4th, we ate out with another couple and had a really nice visit with them. Also that week, we went to the Village Theater to see Live South Pacific. There was a lot of good music and very good acting. I told you I ripped out my shawl and did it all over. I like the looks of it much better now. About two more rows and it'll be finished. It's not quite perfect, but the next one will be considerably better. It just seems to take practice. Your Aunt Irma has had her operation and I believe is back home. She now has an artificial knee besides her two artificial hip bones. Your dad is feeling good. He still swims three times a week and does a lot of walking. August 16th, he goes to Morristown for a new dog. Matty is really sweet and sometimes downright affectionate and lovable. But she has a lot of ailments. She doesn't like to go much either. When we start out, she often tries to turn around and come back home. I met a new friend last week, and she and I take walks several evenings a week. It has been very hot here, but we have been getting rain, which helps a little. Everything grows like in the tropics. There is also something blooming, which smells so sweet. We get a lot of compliments on our yard. You mentioned towels you needed, so if you would like to buy some with this birthday money, it won't buy much, but it's fun to have some mad money. We think of you often, and we'll be glad to hear how you are all getting along. Bye. With love, Mother. Rita showed me that letter many years later. Mom and Dad were always cheerful on the phone after we left Chapel Hill, but I was never sure if they were just trying to reassure me or if they were covering up their difficulties. Apparently, they were doing quite well, and I hadn't needed to suffer guilty thoughts for many years. Chapter 38, Giving Up. When Mom began failing in her early 80s, it became clear that the house and cooking were becoming too much for her. Dad had few housekeeping skills and was unable to take over her chores. He could open a can of soup or make a peanut butter sandwich, but he couldn't cook on a regular basis. He worried how he'd care for her if she had a stroke or otherwise became incapacitated. Arthritis in both her knees had eroded the joints so the bones rubbed on bones, causing her constant pain and limiting her movements. Walking, sweeping the floor, and standing to cook dinner all became difficult. Mom also suffered from Paget's disease, which caused bones in her lower spine to grow too quickly and become deformed, pressing on nerves and causing pain. When she was diagnosed in her late 50s, medication helped, as did back surgery a few years later. Yet the strong pain medications that she took for decades and her barely controlled high blood pressure combined to decrease her kidney functions. Mom's hearing progressively declined, but she would not admit it. I can still hear her say, "Mario, speak up, you're mumbling again." She was adamant that he had a hearing problem and was glad when Dad got his hearing aids, but she refused to acknowledge that she needed her own pair. In a reversal of roles, Mom had begged Dad to get artificial eyes. Dad frequently told her that she'd benefit from hearing aids. Mom didn't appreciate the irony. Dad told me several times about how terrified he was of losing his hearing. How would he communicate without his sight or hearing? And losing the ability to hear his beloved classical music was unthinkable. Helplessly watching her slow physical and mental decline, he didn't know what to do. Their lives had gone well as long as both were healthy. They functioned perfectly as a couple, but one without the other was inconceivable. Hiring a full-time caregiver would be too expensive and would drain their resources quickly. Dad still worried about money, but more importantly, neither wanted an outsider to watch them 24/7 and would possibly cause more problems than they would solve. Privacy and independence were extremely important to them, and the idea of having someone in the house, perhaps judging them or talking too much, was not acceptable. They preferred to read, listen to music, and chat among themselves, not have to keep up a conversation with a stranger. After many phone conversations between my siblings and parents, it became obvious that a change had to be made. They could no longer live on their own. The only option seemed to be an assisted living facility where they'd have help if needed, yet be mostly independent. Deciding upon a location was the next problem. My siblings all lived in the cold Midwest. Mom and Dad enjoyed the temperate climate of North Carolina and didn't want to go back to the snow and ice. I offered to help them find an assisted living facility in Houston. Meals would be provided, staff would be close by, and I could take care of them for errands, doctor's appointments, or to my house and a home-cooked meal. They gratefully accepted my offer and in August 1998 moved to Houston to a facility just minutes from my home. It wasn't easy for them to give up their perfect home in the beautiful town of Chapel Hill to transition to institutional living at Brighton Gardens in Houston. They moved into a small studio apartment that was cooled by a noisy air conditioner. They needed fresh air, but it was usually too hot to open the window, and even on nice days, traffic noise from the street and nearby freeway was an annoying presence. I knew they missed their porch, just being confined to one room with their last dog, Admiral, had to have been almost suffocating. I did everything that I could to make the transition easier. Once a week, I collected their laundry to wash at home. Mom didn't trust the staff to do it properly, and Dad didn't want to pay extra for the service. I didn't mind the additional laundry. I figured that Mom had spent years washing my clothes, so it was the least that I could do for her. Every week, I took them for rides to explore Houston. Dad wanted to know the names of major streets, and at red lights he frequently asked, "Where are we? Which direction does Westheimer go?" We often combined our drives with running errands. They were happy to just get out of that confining room. Sometimes we had lunch at my house. They enjoyed my simple sandwiches, which were a treat for them after eating institutional food every day. After taking them home, I read their mail to them and paid the bills. Occasionally, Jeff and I took them for outings to area state parks or to Galveston. They enjoyed the quiet of Brazos Bend State Park and even held a baby alligator at the park's nature center. I can still hear Dad inhaling the salty fresh air while standing next to the Gulf of Mexico. Mom had severe arthritis in both of her knees and couldn't walk far, but she enjoyed riding in her wheelchair on trails or going into the shops on the Galveston Strand. When Anne came down for a visit, we went on the City of Houston boat tour down the Houston Ship Channel. We described the huge cargo ships docked along the route and attempted to describe what the oil refineries looked like. They loved the ride and the screeching of the seagulls following the boat. Every Sunday, I brought them over for a home-cooked meal made by my husband, Jeff. Afterward, Jeff read the local Houston Chronicle newspaper to Dad, while Mom often fell asleep in my comfortable, overstuffed leather chair. In the summer, they liked to sit out by the pool, enjoying the slightly cooler evening air, while Admiral watched our dog, Goldie, jump into the water. Admiral was unusual for a retriever. He wouldn't follow Goldie's joyful leap to retrieve a floating toy. Once, Admiral slipped into the pool and just slapped at the water with his paws. It was obvious that he didn't know how to swim, so I jumped in and guided him to the steps. He seemed so humiliated, poor dog, and gave the pool a wide berth after that incident. Dad was surprised that he was afraid of the water and surmised that perhaps he'd done some training at the Seeing Eye to discourage water play. I didn't mind devoting so much time to my parents. I'd happily quit my stressful job, knowing that caring for them would be an almost full-time job in itself. I finally felt at peace with myself. I felt that by helping them now, I was making up for leaving them behind in Chapel Hill 20 years earlier. Chapter 39, Saying Goodbye. From the time they moved to Houston in 1998, both parents had frequent doctor appointments, but Mom's health began to deteriorate rapidly. Years of high blood pressure and painkillers for the unrelenting pain of Paget's disease and osteoarthritis took their toll. Her knees were both severely inflamed and swollen, making walking extremely painful and necessitating using a wheelchair when she needed to walk further than a few feet. She developed symptoms of kidney failure, fatigue, swollen legs, and confusion. We went to a nephrologist, a kidney specialist, who did numerous tests and prescribed medications but was unable to prevent further damage. Her last appointment with the nephrologist was in early June. He told her frankly that the only option available was dialysis. She quickly and firmly replied, "No, I don't want to do that." I wasn't surprised by her decision. Mom knew of other Brighton Garden residents who went to dialysis several times a week, and she said that before she didn't want to put herself through such torment. We arrived back at their room, where Dad sat listening to the radio. Upon hearing us enter, he turned off the news and stood to greet us. He was anxious to hear what the doctor had said, but waited until Mom was seated in her usual gold fabric lounge chair. After stowing her wheelchair, I sat on the floor next to Admiral, who was lying at Dad's feet. I stroked Admiral's handsome wide head and fondled his floppy ears while I listened to my parents' conversation. "What did the doctor say?" asked Dad. "That I need dialysis," Mom said bluntly, "but I told him that I didn't want to do that." Dad inhaled sharply, his face stricken, as if he couldn't believe that Mom didn't want to fight the disease. "Mom," I said, "you know what that means if you don't have dialysis." "It means I'll die," she said in a matter-of-fact tone. "Yes, it does. It doesn't sound like a very pleasant death either. Without your kidneys working, you'll slowly be poisoned by your own waste," I explained. "Well, I don't want to be tied to a machine. I'm ready to go. I've had a good life. I'm 85 years old. Nobody in my family has ever lived past 80. So it's my turn." Looking up at my mother, I was surprised at how calm she appeared. Her fair skin, with almost no wrinkles, was smooth. No grimacing or frowning. No tears. No choked voice. I glanced at Dad's face. The reality of losing his beloved Jane was sinking in. I'd never seen him look so sad. His face was contorted as he tried not to cry. He exhaled a heavy sigh. There was no more discussion. She had made her decision. Dad didn't try to convince her to go on dialysis. He knew that she was firm. "Mom, we'll do whatever it takes to make you as comfortable as possible. The doctors gave me hospice information. I'll call them this afternoon." Houston Hospice came the next day and ordered all the necessary equipment and supplies. Ann, John, and Rita flew down to Houston to help me care for her. Yet even with round-the-clock shifts shared among the four of us, we realized that we couldn't provide all the care that she needed. We were unable to relieve her pain and misery. The hospice nurse recommended their inpatient unit. We were relieved that she would get excellent 24-hour care and hoped they would be able to control her pain. Dad stayed with her for hours every day, often lying beside her and holding her hand. He listened attentively to her breathing, noting minute changes. On the evening of July 2nd, he said to me, "Mary, I'm going to stay here tonight with Jane. I'll call you if I need you." "Okay, Dad." I felt bad about leaving them, but knew he needed some privacy. "I'll take Admiral out tonight. Jeff says that he's doing just fine at our house." "Thank you." He turned his head back to my mother and breathed out a long, forlorn sigh. The phone rang at 2 a.m., awakening me from a fitful sleep. I grabbed it and heard Dad say, "Mary, she's gone." Chapter 40, Life Alone. After we returned from Mom's funeral in Muncie, Dad's first request was to move to an even smaller room. There were too many painful memories lurking. He wanted to start fresh and asked me to remove her clothing and possessions. I fought back tears as I packed away her things and wondered if Dad was callous. How could he want to live in a place with no reminders of his wife of 58 years? Now I realized that his memories were all locked in his brain. Photos were meaningless, and the faint, lingering smell of her perfume was painful to breathe. Dad adjusted to life alone at Brighton Gardens. Lonely female residents found him to be a good listener. He enjoyed their conversations to a point, but was always happy to escape back to the comfort of his room. When he wasn't listening to Houston Public Radio, he read talking books on tape from the Texas State Library. When he turned 90, he announced he was going to reread Greek mythology just for fun. He also enjoyed membership at the Cassette Tape Club. Members recorded letters and sent them to one person, who in turn listened, commented, and forwarded on to the next in line. Not all the members were blind, but they all liked to talk into a tape recorder and tell jokes, play music, or discuss current events. Admiral provided comfort and a schedule that gave structure to his day. Every morning, Dad fed him, then took him outside for his morning walk. Just before lunch, Admiral got a snack and again went out for a short walk. Dad usually went for a brisk afternoon walk with him, following the sidewalks inside the property. He had quickly memorized the layout soon after arriving at the facility and had no difficulty finding his way around the grounds. He chose not to walk outside the gates, saying that Houston traffic was too loud and dangerously fast. Unlike Chapel Hill, it was not a walkable neighborhood with nearby businesses or quiet neighborhoods to explore. I tried to spend as much time as I could with Dad, continuing to take him and Admiral on errands two or three times a week. I was surprised at how much easier it was without Mom and felt rather guilty for thinking it. I hadn't realized how much extra time and energy the routine took, waiting for her to get ready, pushing the wheelchair down to the main entrance, helping her get into the car, and finally stowing the wheelchair. Now I simply called Dad to let him know that I was leaving my house, and he said without fail, "Okay, I'll meet you downstairs." By the time I arrived, he was patiently standing next to the driveway. One blazing summer day, I was a few minutes late, As usual, Dad stood in the sun with Admiral lying on the hot cement next to him. Dad, you should wait in the shade. It's too hot to be standing out here. Oh, it doesn't bother me at all. I like it, he said as he settled into the front seat. Come, Admiral. The big yellow lab didn't need a second command. He jumped in and curled up under the dashboard. Dad patted him and found his tail, making sure that it was safely tucked under the dog's body before closing the car door. See how warm he is? His old bones just love that Texas sun. I reached over and felt his soft coat. Wow, he's hot. I just don't want either of you to get overheated. Sorry I'm a little late. Oh, we don't mind at all. I was listening to those old blue jays. They were really squawking at something. They must have a nest close by. Yes, there's a magnolia tree right across the driveway. That's probably where they... maybe they didn't like Admiral. You want to go to the bank first? I asked as I drove out the gate. Although I now had more free time, I had no intention of returning to a paying job, as I was president of a nonprofit, the Fibromyalgia Association of Houston, and that kept me as busy as I wanted to be. We were all volunteers, and I joked at every meeting that, if you don't like the job I'm doing, feel free to cut my salary in half. I also suffered from fibromyalgia, although medication and exercise helped me to keep my symptoms of pain and fatigue under control. I was blessed that Jeff's income was sufficient, as a full-time job would have been impossible for me. Running the organization from my home gave me purpose in life, yet if I got tired and needed a nap, nobody complained. I liked the flexibility and knowing that I was helping others cope with their illness. I enjoyed spending time with Dad. I got to know him in a completely different way, not just as his daughter, but seeing him in a new light without my mother's influence. I wanted to know him as a person, not just roll my eyes when he repeated his stories of long ago. I was grateful to have this opportunity. He was 85 when Mom died, and I decided to make the most of whatever time he had left. He still had an adventuresome spirit and a stunning intellect. I was not going to let him rot in a small room at Brighton Gardens. While most of their first year in Houston was devoted to Mom and her failing health, Dad also had worrisome symptoms. He had survived surgery for stage 2 colon cancer 6 years earlier. Now, at his advanced age, he would not need further treatment. However, his blood chemistry was consistently abnormal, and his doctor referred him to MD Anderson Cancer Center for further tests. He was diagnosed with splenic lymphoma and given a new chemotherapy that had surprisingly few side effects. We went to Anderson for monthly blood work and the doctor appointments. Cancer hospital waiting rooms are filled with anxious, very ill patients, but when Admiral curled up at Dad's feet, people smiled and the tension began to ease. Inevitably, someone would come over and say hello and ask permission to pet the dog. Dad gently refused and explained why. So many people wanted to pet him, including doctors in hospital elevators who reached out and petted Admiral without asking, that I made a bright red sign for his harness. Working dog, please do not touch. Seeing eye dogs become distracted if pet by strangers and may not notice a car or a step. Although that wasn't a problem when Dad walked with me, we still wanted to educate the public about the necessity of resisting the temptation to pet a guide dog. Dad didn't let his cancer interrupt his exercise routine. He used small hand weights in his room and took part in chair exercises with other residents in the morning class. In the summers, he liked to swim in our backyard pool. I taught him some water aerobics. After our sessions, he often said how invigorated he felt. Dad was proud of his strength and his endurance, and a firm believer in exercising both the body and the mind. I could keep him busy, but I couldn't fill the void left by Mom. He needed someone his own age, a peer, to share confidences and worries. Since he left Muncie, Dad had kept in contact with his former secretary and court reporter Francis Middleton. When both were widowed, the telephone calls became more frequent. Dad began asking me to book flights to Indiana, ostensibly to visit Anne at a rural home, but I suspected that he was most interested in spending a day with Francis. The friendship grew into love. They discussed marriage, but Francis didn't want to leave her family and move to Houston, and Dad couldn't move back to Muncie. Daily phone calls and trips to Indiana sustained their friendship. I offered to care for Francis if she wanted to move here, but she was fearful of becoming a burden on me. 3 years after his lymphoma diagnosis, Dad developed severe type 2 diabetes. It was a shock to both of us, as Dad was not overweight and ate a healthy diet. After a week's hospitalization, he was released and referred to the Lighthouse of Houston, an organization that works with blind people and offers diabetes education and management services. He needed to learn how to test his blood sugar and give himself insulin shots. Dad was determined to do everything that the doctor recommended, following every direction to the letter. He had me read labels and counted sugars. He switched to no sugar-added ice cream and artificially sweetened candy and closely monitored his diet. We went to the Lighthouse several times, where we learned about the importance of diet and what to do if the blood sugar level was too low. The instructor patiently taught him how to use a lancet to prick his finger and how to get his blood onto the test strip. She explained how the glucose meter worked and how to insert the test strip. The machine announced the reading, and he wrote down the value in Braille. Once he mastered testing, he learned how to insert the insulin injection into his abdomen. I was surprised at how quickly he memorized the many steps involved with testing and injecting. I would have been constantly referring to the printed manual. Understanding what he needed to do didn't mean that he could easily carry it out physically. Dad had an essential tremor, which meant that his hand shook, especially when bringing food to his mouth. Food fell off his fork or soup splashed out of the spoon. His coffee cup shook, and I worried that he'd be burned. The tremor wasn't serious, but it was certainly annoying and at times embarrassing. Each time he needed to check his blood level, 4 times a day at first, it seemed to take a long time to get all the supplies together. He painstakingly gathered the meter, lancet, test strips, alcohol wipes, used needle container, and insulin injections. He methodically arranged each item so he knew where to find it, and then slowly got up to wash his hands. Finally returning to the table, he sat down and prepared to lance his finger. After working to open the small alcohol pad and cleansing the spot on his finger, he carefully loaded the lance with a sharp needle. His hand wavered as he guided the instrument toward his left index finger. Satisfied that this was in the correct position, he pushed the button and felt for the blood to ooze out. Many times he failed to get blood and was forced to stick himself again. I felt terrible as he made another attempt to prick his finger. But Dad was determined. He had been persistent his whole life, always working harder than a sighted person. Otherwise, he would have spent his life sitting in a chair, being waited on. He had always been independent, and he was not going to allow someone else to test his blood or give him his medicine, even when it would have been easier and sometimes less painful. I tried to rein in my impatience as he moved slowly. It seemed that he often had to check his blood just before going somewhere. I offered to help, to which he usually said, "I can do it." If he had a particularly difficult time pricking his finger and we were in a hurry, he sometimes gave in and allowed me to lance him. Injecting insulin seemed to be easier. He just needed to clean the injection site and hold the syringe at the proper angle to his abdomen. The action didn't require as fine of motor coordination as lancing the finger. "Doesn't that hurt, Dad?" I asked as he plunged the syringe into his flesh. "No, not really. It doesn't bother me at all." I shuddered as I watched him pull the needle out. I was surprised that he could be so casual about injecting himself. I tried to imagine myself doing that several times a day and prayed that I'd never get diabetes. Being diabetic and 88 years old didn't stop Dad from traveling. He carefully packed all his supplies in his carry-on bag and faithfully monitored his health. He continued to fly with Admiral several times a year to Indiana to visit Anne and Frances. Anne told me how sad and frustrated she felt as she watched him try to prick his finger. As he grew older, the tremor worsened, yet he rarely asked for help. When Jeff and I took him on trips, we needed to allow plenty of time for Dad to take care of his needs, whether it was checking his blood sugar levels or going for a walk. Everything took more time than I imagined. Dad walked slower and slower. It was a hard adjustment for me, since he had always been a fast walker. As a child, I hurried to keep up with him, feeling grown up and excited to be walking with my dad. I was saddened, though, as he grew older and frailer, knowing that he would continue deteriorating. I gained still more patience when I slowed down to match his pace. Despite the extra physical and emotional energy required to successfully navigate through each portion of a trip, I continued to plan vacations because I knew how much Dad enjoyed the fresh air, visiting with friends and relatives, and getting away from his small institutional room. Jeff and I loved traveling. While taking Dad with us required extra planning and patience, it wasn't a sacrifice to include him. We took him with us to Orange County, California, where we visited our daughter Katie and went for short walks on the beach. He enjoyed breathing the fresh Pacific Ocean air from a bench perched high on a cliff while listening to the sound of waves breaking on the rocks below. We explored the Riverwalk in San Antonio, picked up shells on Sanibel Island, Florida, and spent a week in the rainforest of Belize. He marveled at the tropical birds singing outside our cabin, enjoying a day exploring the Mayan ruins, and relished the silence of a cave while riding in a canoe. He clicked his tongue often to gauge the height of the cave. He was uncannily correct in pronouncing dimensions of the tunnels and caverns. The summer that Dad was 91, we stayed at a condo for a week in Park City, Utah. He delighted in breathing in the fresh mountain air. He enjoyed the crisp breezes, which provided relief from the heat and humidity of Houston. One day, we went for a drive in the mountains and stopped at a trail near the road. While Dad enjoyed riding in cars, getting out and exploring nature was much more interesting. Uneven paths didn't stop him. He took my arm, and I simply paused when we came to a rock or root and said, "Watch out, there's a big root here that you'll need to step over." He lifted his foot up high, and off we went. Trees fascinated Dad. He liked to touch their bark and feel the shape of their leaves. He knew the names of many by touch, just as he knew the names of birds by their song. If we happened upon a particularly large old tree, I'd stop and have him put his arms around it, just like he used to do when we were kids. I think that Dad was the original tree hugger. "Whoa, I can't even put my arms all the way around it. This must be an ancient tree. How far apart are my hands?" "This thing must be 9 feet in circumference." As we continued on the trail, I stopped by a pile of melting snow that was still on the mountain, despite the warmth of that June day. Since I've lived in Houston for over 40 years, snow is a rarity for me, and I'm always excited to find some. "Hey, Dad, here's some snow. I can't believe there's still some here. It's just down at your feet." He reached down and grabbed a handful. He made a snowball, grinned, and started to throw it at me. "Hey, stop. I've got to get a picture," I said as I quickly pulled the camera out of my bag. "Okay, now you can throw it." The snowball landed just feet away from me, but I got the shot. Dad's red polo shirt and khaki pants stood in contrast to the background of snow and pine trees. He's holding the snowball with both hands, a sly grin on his face, as he anticipates throwing a snowball for the first time in many years. It turned out to be one of my favorite photos of him ever taken. Chapter 41, Admiral. On most of his trips with us, Dad didn't need to bring Admiral. He could walk with us, and taking care of the dog would have been too much. The big yellow lab boarded at the vet's kennel. I know that he would have loved going along, but Dad was firm. I suspect that he relished some time without the responsibilities of tending a dog. In August 2002, after a week in Colorado where Dad enjoyed many hours listening to the rushing mountain stream next to our cottage, we picked up Admiral at the kennel. All seemed normal as I dropped them off at the entrance to Brighton Gardens and drove home. While unpacking later that evening, the phone rang. Glancing at the caller ID, I was surprised that it was Dad. He didn't usually call after dinner. "Mary, something is wrong with Admiral. I think he's dying." "What? But we just picked him up at the vet's. He looked fine." "Well, after you dropped us off, he came up to the room as usual. I removed his harness, and he lay down in the corner. I didn't pay any attention to him, because he always naps when there isn't much going on. But I just tried to take him out to do his business, and when I called him, he didn't respond. I thought he was just tired from being boarded and was just sleeping it off. Then I went to him and petted him, but he still didn't respond. Something is very wrong. I'll be right over." Still in disbelief that Admiral was very ill, I drove as fast as I dared down Bel Air Boulevard. That portion of the road is well known for being a speed trap, and I rehearsed in my mind what I'd say to the Southside police officer if I was pulled over. The stoplight gods were with me. No police cars were hiding, and I made it to Brighton Gardens in record time. Not waiting for the elevator, I took the stairs two steps at a time and walked quickly down the hall to Dad's room. I knocked once, opened the door, and saw Admiral lying stretched out on the floor next to his master's bed. "Hi, Dad," I said as I crossed the room and knelt by the beautiful yellow lab. "Hey, Admiral, how are you doing?" I said as I patted his head and gently rubbed his floppy ears. Dad repeated what he told me over the phone while I noticed the dog's lethargy and lack of response. "You're right, Dad. Something's definitely wrong. I think that I should call the vet." "Well, it's 7:30. She won't still be at the office." "I know, but one time she gave me her cell phone number. Let me try calling." I was relieved when Dr. Frey answered the phone. After a short conversation, she asked if we would like her to come down and see Admiral. Fortunately, she lived only 10 minutes away, and soon she was examining him. "How old is he?" asked the vet. "He looks like he has some years on him." "He's 12," answered Dad. "Without all my equipment, I can't really tell what's wrong, but he needs to go to the emergency clinic tonight. They can run some tests and make a diagnosis," she explained. "Admiral was too ill to walk and too heavy for us to carry." I remembered the luggage cart down in the lobby, ran downstairs, and soon we had Admiral loaded into my SUV. When we arrived at the emergency hospital 15 minutes later, I hurried inside to get some help. I was grateful to learn that Dr. Frey had called ahead and told them to expect us. Almost immediately, two techs brought out a stainless steel cart to the car and carefully unloaded the motionless dog. We watched as they disappeared behind the examining room door, and we settled into the uncomfortable, hard, plastic chairs to wait. Neither of us felt like talking. I didn't want to read aloud as I normally would to pass the time. We sat together alone, but in our thoughts and fears. Dad heavily sighed several times. His face was drawn with worry. I wondered how he would manage without his beloved dog. More than guiding him around dangerous objects, Admiral was a companion, particularly since Mom's death 3 years before. Dad took comfort in his presence, feeling the dog's weight against his feet and legs, or talking to him during the course of the day. "Admiral, let's get your harness on. It's time for your walk." Admiral provided a structure and routine to the day, allowing Dad to focus on another living being and offering a distraction from grieving for Mom. But now Dad faced another potential major loss, and my heart ached for him. I felt my own sorrow. I couldn't imagine life without Admiral. He and my dog Goldie got along very well and enjoyed playing together. Anne and I often wondered who would die first, Dad or Admiral. If Admiral survived my dad, we'd have a family fight on our hands, and John and I all wanted him. Now it seemed that argument would never happen. While I was relieved that he would outlive Admiral, I felt a deep sadness for Dad, grieving again, totally alone in the room without the comfort of his dog. Finally, at about midnight, the vet came to the door and invited us back into the examining room. We've done a CT scan and blood work on Admiral. I'm afraid he has two very aggressive and malignant tumors on his spleen. One has burst and released a lot of blood, so he's very anemic now. Can you do surgery? I asked. We could, but I don't think it would prolong his life more than a few weeks. He's 12 years old, and that's the normal lifespan for a big dog. I think that the surgery would be very hard on him, and he wouldn't be his old self. A small gasp escaped from Dad's lips as his brain processed the news. I felt a lump grow in my throat, and thoughts swirled. How could this be happening? He'd been just fine. Thank God this didn't happen while we were in Colorado, but it should never happen. Admiral should just live forever and die when Dad passes. The thought of separating them was too painful for me to contemplate. Do you want to take him home? No. It was too hard to get him here. We never get him home by ourselves, answered Dad. No. Just keep him. If he gets a lot worse, you can do something. All right. Would you like to come back in the morning and pick him up? The vet asked, looking at me. You can take him directly to your regular vet. He didn't have to say, to be put to sleep. We knew that there were no options. Admiral was clearly suffering. In the morning, his pain would cease. Dad and I drove home in silence. Without his dog, I had to walk with him back to his room. No longer could I just drop Dad and Admiral off at the main entrance and continue on my way. The following morning, I went back to the emergency clinic. A different set of techs gingerly and respectfully loaded Admiral into the back of my SUV and gently closed the tailgate. With tears in my eyes, I drove down the freeway to pick up Dad. It would be Admiral's last ride. Oh, how he loved to go for rides. But this morning, he lay quietly where they placed him in the back. I hoped he was still enjoying the ride. When we arrived at Dr. Frey's clinic, again, two techs came out with a rolling cart and took him inside. We exchanged brief greetings with the staff and were escorted to a small back room where we could spend as much time as we needed with Admiral. Dad sat on a chair with Admiral on the floor next to him. Dad stroked his head, speaking softly to him, telling what a good boy he was and how much he'd miss him. Admiral struggled to sit up and managed to put his head on Dad's knee, causing Dad to gasp when he felt the weight of Admiral's head. His voice choked up as he fought back tears. My tears were streaming uncontrollably down my cheeks. I cried silently, not wanting to interfere with their final goodbye. Admiral slid back down to the floor, unable to sustain a sitting position. Dad, are you ready? Dr. Frey is here. Yes, go ahead. I don't want him to suffer any more. She gave him the shot. Dad reached down and held him with both hands. He didn't feel any quiver or movement. Admiral just slipped away. Minutes later, we left with only his leash. Chapter 42, Walking Alone. Dad was quiet during the short ride back to Brighton Gardens, though he did mention that he now needed a cane. He was worried about walking around the assisted living complex. It was no problem for him to walk alone to the dining room and main living room, but he was afraid of running into an elderly person and perhaps knocking them over. A cane would make it easier for the person to see him coming and either say something or move out of the way. Dad also worried about coming up quickly behind a frail person. The cane would lightly touch them first, warning him of their presence so he could stop and avoid a collision. Residents often stopped suddenly in the middle of a hallway, and he was always on alert, fearful that he would knock someone down. I swallowed hard when he requested help buying a cane. I'd never seen him use one, and it would be a tangible reminder that Admiral was gone. I agreed to call the Lighthouse for the Blind, where he received his diabetes education. I remembered seeing a small shop in the lobby where they sold aids for the blind, such as braille clocks, measuring tapes, and playing cards. I checked to ensure that they had a white cane in stock. We went that afternoon to the lighthouse. I watched Dad as he folded and unfolded the cane, explaining to the sales lady why he needed to buy one that day. Again, a large lump formed in my throat as he told her about Admiral. It felt surreal to be buying a cane. I still couldn't believe that he'd never walk with that beautiful dog again. Dad and I walked slowly and in silence back up to his room. The hall felt empty and quiet without Admiral. I remembered the three of us together, how we'd taken up lots of space in the halls or on the sidewalk, yet Admiral's cheerful presence was always reassuring and joyful. Now it felt almost ghostly in his absence. I was sorry to say goodbye to Dad that night, knowing how empty the room would feel. A few days later, Dad remarked to me how much he missed Admiral. It's been hard. I keep seeing and feeling him, like he's still in the corner where he liked to lay. I developed a pattern of walking around him, because he had certain places that he liked to lay, and I find myself still following that pattern. I've had 61 good years of partnership with the dog, and I guess I have no right to expect any more. Dad, maybe you could get another dog. Dr. Fry said that she'd write supportive letters to the seeing eye. She believes that you could handle another dog. It's something to think about, and I'd help you if you needed it, I pleaded. I couldn't imagine him without a dog. I'd never known him without one. No, I'm too old for a young dog. He'd need lots of fast walks and exercise. I just couldn't keep up with him, and it wouldn't be fair to the dog. Besides, the training at the Seeing Eye is rigorous, and it would be too much for me. So even though I know that you'd be willing to help, I'd still be responsible for all his care. No, it's better for me to use a cane, he said quietly, with a resigned tone. You know, he continued, it's a little like going full circle. Shakespeare talked about the seven ages of man. Well, in a way, that's me. I'm getting back into the field of mobility to where I was when I was 15. Of course, life was much simpler. Traffic moved slowly, there were no complex traffic signals or patterns, and there were a lot of people on the streets. If they saw me standing at a curb, they would lend me a hand if I needed it. Now I'm a lot older, and it's hard for me to go out alone, especially in Houston. I move too slowly, and the traffic won't stop for an old blind man. Besides, there's really no place I can walk to, just a sidewalk that seems to go on forever. You know that I'll take you wherever you want or need to go. Thank you. Did I ever tell you what Jane used to say when she was failing? Without waiting for an answer, he went on. Well, you know how much she loved Admiral. She once told me, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask for a big gold Cadillac. I'll drive up there. Then I'll invite all the dogs and we'll go for a ride, because they all love to ride. But Admiral will get the front seat beside me. Who knows? If I get there and Admiral is sitting on the front seat beside her, I may just have to take him on my lap. I'd be glad to do that. Unsure of what to say, I gave Dad a long hug and tried not to cry. Chapter 43. Thank you. Although his diabetes was stable, the lymphoma that had been diagnosed 5 years earlier began to take its toll on his body. He never complained, but it must have frustrated and scared him to feel his body change and become weaker. At 92, he slept more during the day, often falling asleep in my living room easy chair. Oh, I must have drifted off a little. You know, your chair is just so comfortable. I know, that chair is dangerous. I often fall asleep in it while I'm trying to read. Mom always used to fall asleep there, and when she'd wake up, she'd say that she was just resting her eyes. I didn't believe that for a minute. Dad required blood transfusions occasionally and injections to build up his white blood cells. He was hospitalized 3 times in 6 months for various complications. It seemed that almost every week we went to a doctor appointment at MD Anderson Cancer Center, and sometimes it took over half a day from the time I picked him up until I left him safely in his room in Brighton Gardens. Often I'd bring him to my house for lunch after his appointments. He much preferred leftovers or a sandwich to the restaurant-style meals in assisted living. He didn't complain about the food at Brighton Gardens, but I know that he missed a home atmosphere. Living in a small studio and walking down to the dining room to eat at set times might have reminded him of being at the School for the Blind or Notre Dame. I wonder if he thought that his life had come full circle, that he was once back again in an institution, but now it was his permanent home, with only the end of his life to ponder instead of being a young person with the life ahead of him. I didn't mind the amount of time I spent with Dad. I knew that he wouldn't live forever, and being with him was more important than my errands and chores. I wanted to be able to look back with a clear conscience that I had done all that I could to make his life and Mom's comfortable. Although his body was frail, his mind was still very sharp. He insisted upon taking his own medications. Each bottle was labeled in Braille and kept in a special closet place in his closet. He knew when to take each medicine and refused all attempts by the Brighton Gardens nurses to help him. He was an unusual patient there. Most residents couldn't keep track of their medicines and were dependent upon the nurses to bring their pills at the right time. By the end of June 2006, it was apparent that the medications weren't doing enough. Dad was a great believer in mind over matter, but his body began to fail despite his best efforts. He became resigned to the idea of dying, and while his faith carried him through the spiritual aspects of the process, he was terrified that he'd suffer the worst possible death that he could ever conceive, drowning in his own secretions. He described nightmares where he couldn't breathe, followed by waking up in a sweat. I could only try to reassure him that the doctor should be able to prevent that possibility, but I know that he remained unconvinced. While waiting for Dr. Vu at his final doctor appointment, I fixed my gaze upon a close-up photo of a bright yellow sunflower. Evidently meant to cheer in an otherwise sterile exam room, it failed to lighten my mood. Dad and I sat on the hard plastic chairs. He was quiet, and I didn't feel like talking or attempting to entertain him, as I had done on our previous visits. Occasionally, he breathed out a deep sigh and shifted position, but otherwise he seemed lost in his thoughts. We heard a light tap, and the door opened with a swoosh. Dad and I sat up straighter in our chairs and looked at her expectantly. "Hello, Mr. Peroni. It's Dr. Vu. How are you doing?" she asked as she reached out to shake his proffered hand. She glanced at me and said, "Hello," but her eyes were clearly on her patient. Dr. Vu sat down on the rolling stool and scooted almost knee to knee with him. "Hello, doctor," he responded. "I'm doing about as well as could be, I expected, I guess. Do you have any pain?" "No, no pain. Sometimes it's a little hard to breathe." "Yes, well, you know that when you were in the hospital last week, we drained your right lung once and your left one twice. You had a lot of fluid, so that's why you had trouble breathing." "I know. Can you drain them again?" "Unfortunately, no. The fluid would just come right back. Your body isn't able to excrete the fluid, even with the diuretics you've been taking. There's really nothing more we can do." Dad was silent for a moment. "Does that mean I'll drown in my own secretions?" he asked with a shudder. "That just terrifies me." "Oh, no," Dr. Vu quickly tried to reassure him. "You'll get medicines from hospice that will keep you comfortable. We won't let you have a drowning sensation." Dad didn't look convinced. "I don't understand how that will work. If you can't keep my lungs from filling up again, well, you'll have oxygen if you need it, and the medicines will help relax you. If you have any pain, they'll give you painkillers." "Okay," he responded, still convinced that he would die while struggling to breathe. "Dad," I interrupted, "remember that you have a caregiver staying with you 24 hours a day. She will help you with anything that you will need and will call hospice if you need more medicine or whatever." Dad was a very private person and at first had resisted having someone else in his room, but he quickly realized the comfort of knowing that help was there if he needed her and seemed to enjoy the company and attention. Dr. Vu reached for his hand and held it. I was touched that she was trying to reassure him, taking the time to be with a 92-year-old man at his last doctor appointment. I swallowed hard, trying to keep from crying. "You know," he said, "I've had a very good and long life. It wasn't easy, and sometimes it took every bit of energy I had to get through the day. But I don't have any regrets. I loved my wife, and I had her for 58 years. I had a wonderful family. I wouldn't change a thing. Dr. Vu smiled. How did you meet your wife? Dad brightened. Oh, well, we met at the Indiana School for the Blind back in fourth grade. Would you like to hear the story? Oh, yes, please tell it. Dr. Vu released his hand and sat up, waiting for him to begin. Dad shifted in his chair, squared his shoulders, and began. I was sitting at my desk. It was after Christmas, sometime in January, when the teacher said that a new girl would be joining the class. At that time, they were very strict about separating the boys from the girls. The boys were on one side of the classroom, and the girls were on the other side. The next day, the new girl was seated right across the aisle from me. I couldn't talk to her, since there were strict rules about interacting with the opposite sex, but I loved it when she had to stand to recite, because she stood right close to me in the aisle. I could have reached out and touched her, but of course that was forbidden. I still recall the first time she made a big impression on me. She was asked to stand up and recite this poem. So here hath been drawing another blue day. Think, wilt thou let it slip useless away? Out of eternity, this new day is born. Into eternity, at night, will return. When he finished, Dr. Vu looked wide-eyed at me, then back at Dad. Oh, my gosh! Do you remember that poem from hearing her say it once, back when you were in fourth grade? Smiling, he replied, Oh, yes, I've never forgotten that poem. I loved the sound of her voice. Who wrote it? Do you remember the title? Thomas Carlyle is the author, and the title is Today. Wow! Dr. Vu looked at me in wonder. How could you remember that for so many years? That's amazing. You must have an incredible memory. Maybe so, but it was when I first fell in love with Jane. Hearing her voice recited over and over in my brain helped when we were apart and I was lonely. That's so sweet. Well, Mr. Peroni, it's been a pleasure having you as a patient. You have my cell phone number if you have any questions. Don't hesitate to call, she said as she stood to leave the room. Thanks for all you've done for me. You've been very helpful. Dad and I slowly walked along the corridors of MD Anderson Cancer Center, winding our way down to the elevators. Although wheelchairs were plentiful in the clinic, Dad insisted on walking, saying, I need the exercise. While I appreciated his desire to keep moving, his glacial pace tried my patience. We could have made it to the car much quicker if he had agreed to go in the wheelchair. Now I understood that he was proud to walk on his own, and the extra 15 minutes that it took was nothing compared to his feeling that even though he was dying, he still had the energy and the desire to walk. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.